Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Observers generally view Kissinger as a larger-than-life figure, a hero or a villain, a savior or a war criminal. He was, in fact, none of these things. Kissinger did not transcend his times like some Olympian great man. Instead, he adapted to changing circumstances and seized unpredicted opportunities as they arose. His career, like the American century as a whole, was not inwardly driven. It was deeply affected, sometimes distorted, by external factors. These included military conflicts far from North America, the collapse of foreign societies, and the emergence of aggressive regimes. The American century was a response to international transformations. It was a global century.
On the one hand, Henry Kissinger won the Nobel Prize, the Nobel Peace Prize. On the other, several governments are still interested in questioning him as a possible war criminal. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
As National Security Advisor and Secretary of State during the Nixon and Ford presidencies, how much did Henry Kissinger instigate and influence U.S. actions in Vietnam, China, and the Third World? What was his grand strategy? And was being Jewish a help or a hindrance, especially when it came to dealing with the Middle East? And ultimately, how much of today's international power structure is the product of his initiatives? Our guest, once again, is Jeremy Suri, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and author of many books, including the one that he read from just now, Henry Kissinger and the American Century, published by Harvard University Press in 2007.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
On the cover of your new book, you have a picture of Kissinger on the cover of Time magazine, which kind of calls our attention to the fame, the fact that
right.
Kissinger's voice and his face, now it would have to be one of the most recognizable voices and faces of the 20th century.
Absolutely. It's extraordinary to me whenever I travel, and I was just traveling in Europe for the past few months, how recognized he is and how everyone, no matter where you go, has an opinion about him. You can always start a conversation by telling someone that you're interested or working on Henry Kissinger. You can't do that if you mention Jimmy Carter or if you mention Gerald Ford. And in fact, those two men could walk down the street in the middle of Paris and no one would know who they were. Henry Kissinger immediately has this fame, has this image. And I think there are a number of reasons for that. The three that stand out in my mind very quickly are, number one, I think he was the leader of the United States, or at least the foreign policy maker, the leading foreign policy maker of the United States at a time of great transformation and controversy. And so he became a figure who drew a lot of that in a way Nixon didn't, because Nixon's a little harder to defend at many levels than Henry Kissinger. Second, Kissinger's dual role as an intellectual as well as a policymaker fascinates people. And then third, his background as a German-Jewish immigrant fascinates people as well. And those are three of the themes that I spent a lot of time thinking about in my book because I think they're so important in understanding him and understanding the way our world has changed.
Well, let's start with number three, Kissinger as a German Jew. I'm fascinating in that, at least to my knowledge, there had never been a foreign-born Secretary of State before or since. No. Well, Madeleine Albright
would be there.
Since.
Right, he's the first. And in many ways, he opens that door. He is the first person to be Secretary of State who does not fit the mold of almost every other foreign policymaker in the United States. And what was the mold before Kissinger? Well, it was the mold of being from one of the elite families, going to a set of elite schools, and in a sense, not having a great deal of foreign policy experience, though a few secretaries of state did, but more being part of the in political crowd within the United States. Kissinger, of course, does not fit that at all. And I think that's the most important thing we need to recognize in his career. His career is about the internationalization or globalization of American foreign policy. New people from different backgrounds now become important foreign policy players because their knowledge is seen as useful for American policymaking. And that's why after Kissinger, you get in a sense a flood tide of foreign-born or at least foreign-influenced policymakers, Zbigniew Brzezinski as NSC advisor, Madeleine Albright, as you mentioned, Norman as foreign policy Secretary of State, and to some extent Condoleezza Rice, I think, fits this mold.
Well, let's go to 1923 Germany, when Henry Kissinger is born. And can you tell us the kind of background that he was born into and what difference it made that he went through the rise of Nazi Germany?
I think it's enormous in understanding his career. He's raised as an Orthodox Jew, and this is very important. He's in a community where Jews are very well represented and in large number and live relatively, shall we say, comfortable lives, but they're not fully assimilated into German society. And so he lives a life of being a German and also a Jew, and both are very, very important to him. And that is, of course, why he's forced to flee in 1938 with his family. With the rise to power of the Nazis, the low-level Jewish intolerance becomes, of course, violent, and his family begrudgingly has to leave. People look at this and they say, well, this is a typical story of someone coming to America and finding opportunity. And of course, there is something to that, but it's terribly oversimplified. It's a much more traumatic experience for him. And in fact, when his family comes to New York City, they move to Washington Heights, north of Columbia University. And that is a part of New York City that's actually a little German Jewish ghetto in New York. It really is. The major newspapers are in German. People speak predominantly German. And there are numerous synagogues there, at least 5 Orthodox synagogues, and the Kissinger family joins the most Orthodox of them. That is Kissinger's socialization as an American. This experience is crucial because, first of all, anti-Semitism and popular hatred are at the center of his vision of society. Weimar democracy that he grew up in his first 13 years was a very democratic society, at least until 1933, for the first 10 years of his life. More political representation, in fact, in the United States, a wider range of political parties, a more vibrant art scene. But yet it was also a society that nurtured and then after 1933 accepted and supported violent hatred. And
not just from the Nazis. Apparently there were a number of parties that had their own militias even.
Exactly, exactly. And I did, in doing research on this, something that maybe isn't the best historical methodology, but I went to look for something. You're never supposed to actually look for something. But I went to look for resistance in his community, where his father was a pretty well-respected teacher. His mother was from a very well-respected family among Jews. And you could not find, I could not find any significant resistance to the Nazis in his community.
So your thesis, sort of, if I followed you right in the first parts of the book, is that Kissinger's distrust of the democratic process, the way that he would later on sort of go behind the scenes and operate almost like a rogue Secretary of State, that partly can be traced back to what happened in Germany where he saw that democracy didn't guarantee goodness.
Correct. I think that's definitely part of it. He is a skeptic, or shall we say he is someone who is concerned about the inherent violence and instability of democracy. He's also a believer that democratic decisions are not necessarily better decisions. And he also believes, and this is the corollary to that, that democratic states are often too slow to act. It's not just that the Democrats in Germany didn't do anything to protect his family. It's that the democratic societies around Germany didn't do anything as well.
Well, look at England in 1938 appeasement.
Well, exactly. And when he came to the United States in 1938, the United States was basically pursuing a series of neutrality laws and attempting at least publicly to stay out of the war. FDR had to break the war. FDR had to violate the Constitution. FDR had to act undemocratically to get us to support Britain in 1940-41 before the attack on Pearl Harbor. That's a lesson Kissinger learned and imbibed very seriously.
You say that, in fact, his most important attribute of a leader is courage, the courage to act, let's say, contrary to what the popular will might be at the time.
Yes. I think for Kissinger, the heroic leader is, and he says this over and over again in everything he writes, the heroic leader is almost a romantic figure. The phrase he uses is, the leader knows before his, and it's always a his for him, before his citizens know. So it's not that the leader is a dictator forcing his citizens to do things, but the leader is a visionary who sees a place, who sees a threat and sees a solution before the citizens do, pursues that policy and convinces them in the doing of that policy. And that's, I think, actually how Kissinger attempted to run things when he was in the White House.
Did he admire FDR then?
He did. He admired FDR and Churchill, both of them. Churchill even more so because he felt that Churchill had the rhetorical presence to sell a policy after the fact. He admired both of them because they did things that were unpopular at the time for a larger cause. He admired them for their courage. But I think most of all, he admired them for what he saw as their forethought, thinking forward beyond the everyday. FDR's post-war planning from the day we enter the war, for example. Churchill's concerns about the Soviet Union from the day we actually become allied with them. Many historians criticize this. They say this was actually putting the cart before the horse, and maybe that's right. But for Kissinger, this was effective leadership planning down the road.
You write in your book that really World War II is what made Kissinger. How so?
In a number of ways. I mean, the most obvious and important one is he becomes a citizen of the United States because of the war. As I said, he is really not a full-fledged American, even resident, in 1938-39. After Pearl Harbor, he's drafted into the Army, and he actually volunteers to join, but he would have been drafted anyway, and he's made a citizen in the Army, as many other Jewish immigrants at the time were. And the Army gives him status, education, and belonging as an American. He said to me in interviews, and he said elsewhere, that he first thought of himself as an American in this context. He actually refers to people from Wisconsin and Indiana. He says, I was down in the South in boot camp, and I was with these middle Americans. And I felt connected to them. We were all one. It's the first time Kissinger is not in a kosher environment. It's the first time he's not in an Orthodox environment.
He's really seeing America.
That's right. And the other thing that's really important for us to understand is it's not that he becomes an American just because he's in the Army. It's because the Army sends him back to Germany. He becomes an American serving in the U.S. Army in Germany because he now then has a valuable role to play. He's overseeing the occupation of German society. That gives him a stake in American society, and it puts him in contact with powerful figures.
Now, you mentioned that you interviewed Kissinger, which made me wonder, as you're writing a book that will, on some level, criticize his policies,
yes.
How much openness did you find that he had when you met with him, and how aware was he of the thrust of your book?
And how open did you feel you could be in writing the book, knowing that he'd see it?
Wow. Those are all very difficult questions that I continue to struggle with. Well, he's not very open to criticism at all, and that's an understatement. This is a man who, to say he thinks highly of himself is to understate. He is someone who likes to discuss and argue serious issues, and he, in our, I think, 7 or 8 meetings, would constantly, in a sense, encourage me to argue with him, but then he could not take even the smallest criticism. There's an insecurity, I think, that you can't get over in someone who's achieved so much but yet doesn't feel secure in what he's achieved. That said, he wants to talk about these issues, but he doesn't want to be criticized for these issues. He understands that my book is an attempt to understand his life and interpret what he did, that it's not an attempt to say everything about everything he did. That would be a 2,000-page book that people would have trouble slogging through. And in fact, I think the scholarship on Kissinger has suffered, both critical and positive, when it gets too caught up in the details. I'm trying to understand why he did what he did and what that tells us about American society. And I think he wants someone to write that kind of book. But I think there are parts of my book he'll disagree with. I hope he'll respect the fact that I think he does deep down that I've tried to be serious and not condemn him nor glorify him, but understand him in his context. But I think that's hard to deal with. I think it'll be hard for anyone to deal with. I'm very critical of him in Vietnam, and I think anyone should be, and I think that would be hard for anyone to deal with.
How did being in Europe then shape Kissinger's thinking after 1945?
I think on a number of levels. First of all, being back in Europe at the end of the war, I think he came to see, in the phrase that Malin Albright will later use, that the United States was an indispensable nation over there. And even more deeply, I think he came to believe that there was such something called Western civilization. He was educated in Germany to believe this is what the Germans call Bildung, and that the United States was now the new protector, that in a sense the baton had been passed from the great European powers of the 19th century to the United States. This meant for Kissinger, I think, that the United States not only had to play a major role as a military power, but the United States had to play a major role protecting certain values. And I interpret his anti-communism as not simply a revulsion toward the Soviet Union and toward communist ideology, but to what he saw as a threat to basic Western values, as he defined them, of individual freedom, personal property, freedom of conscience, and representative government, not necessarily democratic government, but representative government. It's extraordinary to me that a man who wrote as much as he wrote, and we should recognize he is still one of the most published figures in the 20th century. Reading his work, it takes a lifetime unto itself. For all that he wrote on almost every foreign policy issue, he wrote almost nothing about the nature of communism. Because it wasn't about communism. It was about what communism threatened for Western civilization. It wasn't about the doctrines of Marx. It was more about communism as an alternative and therefore a threat to what he saw as true Western civilization.
Can you say something about his education, and particularly the way at Harvard he was both an insider and an outsider?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is one of the themes of my book, that he's this inside-outsider. In the Army and in his experience in World War II, he becomes an insider for a couple of reasons. First of all, he has this experience of occupation. He has practical knowledge. He oversaw the reconstruction of two towns in Germany at
the age of 22. That's amazing, with no college education. He had actually done part of a year at City College in New York Night School, and he had worked in a brush factory. He had just become an American citizen, and he oversees the occupation of two cities, and he did a pretty good job, from what most people say. So that gives him a kind of practical knowledge. He had proven his intellectual acumen in the military by dealing with complicated issues at many levels, and he had developed mentors who recognized him and promoted him in that context. And then there's the third issue that most people don't like to write about, but I think is absolutely serious, his Jewishness. His Jewishness makes him an insider and an outsider. He's an insider because his Jewishness means that he cannot be favorably inclined toward Nazism or fascism. And that's why he's sent back to occupy. If you look at the roles, the list of people who served in counterintelligence in the same position he served, you find a lot of German Jews. They have knowledge of German society, they speak the language, but they're Jewish, so they can't be pro-Nazi. That makes him an insider, but because he's Jewish, he's also now an outsider at the same time. And that's what he encounters at Harvard University. He's admitted to Harvard in a special class that Harvard creates for GIs coming back from the war, in particular Jews. They're encouraged to do this by the federal government to show that we are different from the Nazis and the Soviets. They're encouraged to do this because these German Jews have valuable knowledge that can be used. When he's brought in, though, it's quite clear that there are certain things he can and cannot do. He has access to members of the faculty and members of the U.S. government. He's already advising the government who want to use his knowledge of Germany for American policy. But he is not allowed to go into certain fields that are not open to people from that background. It was impossible for him to even consider becoming a professor of literature. That's an area that's closed off. And in fact, literature is very late in most universities to have any Jewish faculty.
Why is that?
Because it's seen, literature is seen, as is American history, as areas protecting an American identity, protecting an American essence, and only proper Americans could teach those fields. So even at a place like the University of Wisconsin, you do not have a Jewish historian on the faculty until George Mossy is hired in the late 1950s, and it takes almost another decade to get a Jewish faculty member teaching American history. He was brought in, like Kissinger at Harvard, to teach German history, not to teach American history. And that's built into the system. So there are areas that are closed off to Henry. He also, by the way, is forced to live only with Jewish students in the dormitories at Harvard. There's internal discrimination, just as he's given access to power at the same time. And I would say this becomes the model for the rest of his career. Throughout his career, his background and the knowledge he gained from it gives him purchase on power. But his background also makes him suspicious, especially to those who look at power from the outside.
Does he ever start protesting that, or do you sense in anything you've read any anger, any bitterness about that?
I sense a lot of anger and bitterness, and this came up in a number of our interviews, and I should say there were things he said about this, some of which I quote in the book, some of which he asked me not to, and I couldn't. And what I didn't quote is very emotional. And this is deeply built into him. He never, that I can find, ever protested this. His strategy was always to just deal with it, or to turn it to his advantage, as he does later in the Middle East when making policy. And that was his strategy. I think it's a strategy also born of his experience, seeing that actually the solution in Germany, there was not a possibility of resistance. That
so you work around what you have to deal with.
You work around it as best you can. You find allies. His entire career depended upon finding, shall we say, WASPy mentors who would promote him, from William Elliott at Harvard to Nelson Rockefeller to Richard Nixon.
And after World War II, it became almost fashionable to accommodate Jews, at least to that extent.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a fair criticism. I think he took advantage of that sort of, you might even say, a quota system that develops. He became the good Jew. I think that's definitely how Rockefeller thought of it, and I think he consciously took advantage of it. I have to say, though, I sympathize with him. I would have probably, in his shoes, I would hope, have done different things, but I sympathize with the fact that he was someone who believed he had to make his way in society for his own purposes. He thought there were moral purposes he had to serve in foreign policymaking, and that he had to do this dealing with some very, very hostile people that he had to kiss up to at the same time. That's for better or worse, is power, I think.
You say that he wrote a thesis called, what was it, The Meaning of History?
The Meaning of History, yes. It's to this day still the longest undergraduate thesis ever written at Harvard.
338 pages.
338 pages. Reflections on Toynbee, Kant, and Spengler. This written by, at that point, a 24-year-old, I think 25-year-old, who's just, you know, just come out of the war. But it again captures what we were talking about, Emily, the sense of there being a core set of Western ideas that have to be protected. And that's what this is about.
Well, it's a little audacious to call it The Meaning of History.
It is. This is someone who's never lacked Kissinger for ambition or audacity.
We'll see how far that ambition and audacity took him when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
that holds the thing together, a year or two. Afterwards, after a year, Mr. President, Vietnam will be a backwater. If we settle, let's say, this October, by January 74, no one will give a damn.
Henry Kissinger in conversation with Richard Nixon, talking not so much about strategy vis-a-vis war in Southeast Asia, but the covering up of strategy and the marketing of strategy. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Jeremy Suri. Is this a pattern that Kissinger developed early?
I think it is. I think he becomes very convinced that for substantive foreign policy reasons, it's often important to sell a particular image of policy. And I think that's one of the things he learned from FDR and Churchill, that it was very important not just to convince the public to do something it's already doing, but to convince it, in fact, maybe that you're doing something you aren't already doing. And he gets involved in this actually in the 1950s when he's working as a very, very young man, as an undergraduate and a graduate student. It still amazes me. Advising the Eisenhower administration on so-called psychological strategy in Korea and elsewhere. And he's one of the strongest advocates early on of threatening to use nuclear war. He never advocates going to war with nuclear weapons. I think he abhors that. He understands as well as anyone what that would mean. But the importance of actually going through a set of measures to try to threaten your enemy, but also he believes during the Korean War to give the American people some belief that there's something we can do, that we still have options. He talks about creating smaller nuclear weapons and the possibility of at least appearing to be ready to use them for the purpose of giving the American people some belief that there's an alternative between all or nothing. So this use of image and manipulation, I think, is very, very important to what he sees as necessary for bolstering public confidence in policy.
I guess I'm interested in how he got so far so quickly. Yeah. You write in your book that by the 1960s, Henry Kissinger had become one of the most recognized, respected, and influential strategic experts in the world. And I'm curious, what if he goes from that thesis on the meaning of history at Harvard,
right?
He's advising people sort of behind the scenes,
right?
And then he goes to this top spot. What is it that propels him to that?
Well, that's a great question. There are a couple of things. I mean, one is he just worked harder than anyone else, and he still is this way. I mean, this is a man who's worked 20-hour days all his life. What he does from the time he's an undergraduate on at Harvard is he outworks everyone. He writes on every possible issue and writes seriously on every possible issue. This is not someone who just recycles the same thing over and over again. So as he's finishing his 300-page thesis as an undergraduate, he's already beginning to write reports for the federal government on various issues like civil-military affairs in Korea, which he knows something about from Germany, psychological strategy. He's beginning to write about contemporary security issues for journals like The Reporter, which used to be a pretty prominent journal at the time, Foreign Affairs, places like that, and meeting people through these. In the mid-1950s, then as a graduate student, and then as a kind of, for a while, an unemployed academic, and then a faculty member, he writes a number of articles and books that get a lot of attention, the most famous being Nuclear Weapons and Foreign Policy, which is published in 1957, which is this thick 400-page book that grows out of a series of discussions at the Council on Foreign Relations on nuclear strategy. And this is where he talks about changing American nuclear strategy to make nuclear weapons more usable in war. It's a very controversial book. A lot of people disagree with what he's written, but it's also a very important book that really captures a debate at the time. Many people are unsatisfied with the Eisenhower administration's strategy. So it's actually his writings and his networking that allow him to do this. One other thing he does at Harvard is he runs, from his days as a graduate student on, a summer seminar that the university sponsors. It's called the International Seminar, bringing in foreign policy figures, young foreign policy figures from all across the world, primarily Europe, but all across the world, or they at least claim, to Harvard to spend a few weeks talking about foreign policy and talking about Western civilization. Kissinger's the organizer of this, so he gets to meet everyone, and he uses this to network. So it's through hard work at networking and hard work at writing that he becomes so prominent. It's a really important point because people look back now, especially many people who dislike Kissinger's policies, and they say, oh, he was always a lightweight thinker. People didn't take him seriously. He was always this crazy guy. A lot of scholars say that now, and it's just not true. One of the things I did in my book is I quote a lot of the reviews of his work. Serious people took this man seriously at a very, very young age.
1957, and he's already talking about more flexible use of nuclear weapons.
Flexible response, in fact, yes.
Yeah. And this is at a time when Soviet Union, United States are the big nuclear powers, China not yet a player by about 7 years.
Correct, 64 for China.
So what is his global thinking at 1957 and forward?
I think he has a pretty consistent vision. It's, of course, altered a little bit as he goes along. But I think you could say by the late 1950s, he has a pretty consistent vision that helps to explain his foreign policy for the rest of his career. And this is one of the arguments, of course, I make in the book. And I'll just point to three key elements of it. First, limits. And this is in everything he writes. He is someone very concerned with the limits of American power. And you can lose sight of this when you just look at individual policies of his, but as a whole, his policymaking is about the need for global leadership, but the limits on American global leadership, the inability to convince a democratic public to be involved everywhere, the limits on American resources to be involved everywhere. So the first element of his strategy is trying to figure out a way to lead globally without having to be involved globally everywhere all the time.
As the United States is already just starting to get involved in French Indochina,
exactly.
For example.
Exactly, exactly. So this is really important. This will later become the so-called Nixon doctrine, the idea of choosing surrogates for us, like the Shah, like Israel, like the Egyptian government, to actually play the role as our enforcers, in a sense. That's already there in the late 1950s. I think he sees that from World War II, seeing how overextended the United States gets, even just in Europe and Asia during World War II itself. He recognizes this issue. Second, I think there's a sense of hierarchy. This is really important. This comes from his German education. It comes from his experience in policymaking, a sense in which the world is not egalitarian, never will be. And in his eyes, international organizations, while they might serve a purpose, can't substitute for that. So for him, it's a world of hierarchy. Certain parts of the world are more important. Certain parts of the world have more say than other parts. And certain parts of the world deserve more attention than others. And of course, Europe is at the center of this vision. Africa and Latin America are not. And quite honestly, I think he inherits a colonial view, as I say in the book, of those areas, which is to say he doesn't believe they should be colonized or destroyed, but he believes they're less important and can be sacrificed in some ways for the needs of the more important parts of the world. This, I would say, is a very 19th century German view of the world that he inherits that I would say becomes the American view. This is one way in which the internationalization of American foreign policy becomes, in a sense, the Europeanization of American foreign policy. The third crucial element of his foreign policy thinking, in addition to hierarchy and limits, is a sense in which force and diplomacy have to be brought together. And he's continually critical of the U.S., I think, legitimately, for not recognizing this. He says, Americans tend to think, because of our somewhat ideological view of the world, that you either deal with people who you think are legitimate, or if someone's illegitimate, you don't deal with them, and you either ignore them or you go to war with them. And Kissinger is consistently opposed to that. His argument is that we must always marry force to negotiations, which means we must use force, perhaps more than many other Americans would agree, but we also must negotiate, even with the most odious of enemies. And he's always in favor. One has to give him credit. He is always in favor of negotiations. He is, for instance, supporting negotiations with the North Vietnamese from the day Americans begin to replace the French there. He supports negotiations with all kinds of groups throughout his career, while he also supports the use of force.
And what is his concept of the presidency, the office of the presidency? I mean, he goes through so many different administrations, yeah. And he must have opinions of various leaders. But I'm also just, you know, interested in coming out of his background, having his hierarchical sense of things. What does he think of the office and the, sort of his role in relation to it?
Well, he certainly believes in a strong presidency, to say the least. And I think he believes the president must be a figure who has a foreign policy strategy and then conducts that strategy. There's very little room in Kissinger's rhetoric, in his planning, in his thinking for Congress to play a role or for the American people on a day-to-day basis. I think he believes the president is elected to pursue a foreign policy and should pursue that policy with a set of consistent strategic aims for 4 years, and then we should have a mandate on that figure. I think that's the way he views the office. He's very critical of bureaucracy, as many intellectuals were in the 50s. Thinks that bureaucracy, including the State Department and the Pentagon, tie up policy. Bureaucrats develop their own local interests. You send an ambassador, he says, to a country, that ambassador goes native and says that country deserves all kinds of special treatment and doesn't see it in strategic terms. So he long advocates, and especially from the Kennedy years on, the White House developing its own mechanism for conducting foreign policy. And this is a crucial theme we have to recognize. This begins only in the 1960s, when the White House develops a National Security Council that actually will now run foreign policy. The NSC goes back to World War II. It was created by FDR, but it was created for administrative purposes. Eisenhower used the NSC for thinking about issues and for administrating about issues, not for making policy on a day-to-day basis. Kennedy changes that with McGeorge Bundy, Kissinger's former dean at Harvard, as the NSC advisor. Kissinger's part of that. And from the Kennedy years to the present, foreign policy will be made largely in this unelected body without congressional oversight in the White House. The NSC advisor is not confirmed by Congress. And this gives the president enormous power to make policy quickly and secretly, and then only to be accountable after the fact. Kissinger intends for it to be that way, as McGeorge Bundy and John F. Kennedy intended for it to be that way, and that's the way he pursues policy for the president.
What is his take on the Vietnam War as the Johnson administration ramps it up?
Kissinger is never a, shall we say, an enthusiast for the Vietnam War. He's different from Walt Rostow and Dean Rusk and Robert McNamara early on, though Robert McNamara would tell you different things now. But he's different from them. He never believes in two things that they believe in. One, he never, ever believes that Vietnam will be made this democratic capitalist society. And if anything, Kissinger is in much more agreement with, shall we say, the Southern racists like Senator Richard Russell, who tell Johnson on the telephone in May of 64, why are you wasting your time there? These guys will never make it out of prehistoric civilization, as I think Russell refers to it. Kissinger's actually more in agreement with that than he is with the other people around Kennedy and Johnson in the White House. Second, he does not see the overriding strategic importance of Vietnam as Vietnam per se.
Domino theory for him.
Exactly. Well, he believes in it, but not necessarily that Vietnam is the crucial element. I think he would argue Taiwan or Korea were more significant because of their economic and geographical standing. So he's not an enthusiast for the Vietnam War, but he is not an opponent either. He falls in, I would say, with the majority of people who viewed the war, especially intellectuals and policymakers who were also intellectuals like himself at the time, believing that once the United States got committed, it had to see things through. And that at that point, once we're involved, and this now goes back to the 1950s when we begin to pay the French bills, that from that point on, our credibility, our reputation is at stake. And he continually, from the mid-60s on, looks for a way for the United States to find a successful conclusion and extraction from the war. So as early as 1966, he's organizing negotiations with the North Vietnamese through the French to find some way to create a stable South Vietnamese government so the United States can withdraw. He does not want communist expansion in the area, but he does not want a long-term American military commitment. And everything he does is in that direction. The problem is that in order to extract the U.S. and in order to provide some kind of publicly acceptable, decent interval, as he later talks about it with Nixon, he's willing to use a variety of means that, shall we say, are morally questionable. Not just negotiations, which he continually supports, but also bombing. Also increasing the scale of the violence so long as it's not always the Americans who are suffering. In fact, the less Americans are responsible for on-the-ground suffering, the more he's willing to increase the level of violence. So that's where you get this curious situation in the early 1970s where Kissinger is ramping up the bombing beyond World War II levels in Vietnam, withdrawing American soldiers and negotiating with the North Vietnamese at the same time. It seems contradictory to most people, but it actually fits perfectly with what he's trying to do. He's trying to make sure things look good in terms of for the United States to preserve our credibility. The bombing shows were strong. He's trying to negotiate a way out. That's why he's negotiating. And he's trying to get American soldiers out so American citizens don't suffer so Nixon can get reelected.
Well, and that brings me to the question of his involvement in the sort of the election process, the political process. He is a Republican, sort of.
Yes and yes. No, yeah.
I mean, to what extent is he part of the political parties?
He really isn't. I mean, the thing about him, and this is the thing that fascinates people and fascinates me, he transcends that. I mean, he advises every president from Eisenhower on, and this includes Kennedy and Johnson. And Johnson uses him as a negotiator in Vietnam. The only president who really didn't pay a lot of attention to him was Ronald Reagan. Though Reagan also talked to him a little bit, but Reagan was the one president who really didn't pay much attention to Kissinger. He is more associated with the Republican Party because of his connection to Nelson Rockefeller and then, of course, to Richard Nixon. But the Republican Party of Henry Kissinger then would be a kind of middle-of-the-road conservative Republican Party, not the Republican Party of Reagan and Bush now. With regard to elections, I think it's a couple of things that are happening. He had a lot of experience, actually, with electoral politics because he was Nelson Rockefeller's advisor on all foreign policy matters. And in the 1960s, when Nelson Rockefeller was running for president, foreign policy was the big issue.
Ran three times.
Three times, right. And so Kissinger had a lot of experience. He'd been to all the party conventions, et cetera. So he had an understanding of this, though never as good an understanding as he thought he had. But the real issue with Nixon is Nixon was always concerned about this and got everyone involved. And so as the clip we have shows, he's constantly pushing on Kissinger to do things that will help the president get reelected. And Kissinger's no choice. He can't tell the president, well, I'm sorry, Mr. President, I don't care whether you get reelected or not. I've got to pursue this policy. It's a big issue, especially because of Kissinger's position. Again, he's the inside outsider. He has the inside access to the president, inside access to policy. But he is a creature of the president. He's an outsider. Nixon can get rid of him at any moment before 1973 because he's not Secretary of State. He's NSC advisor. He serves at the whim of the president. And this is Kissinger's career, right? Inside, outsider. He's an insider, but he doesn't have his own independent standing. He's an outsider in the White House.
As an intellectual and a worldly person and a person with a clear vision as to how he thought democracy should work globally, what did Kissinger think of Nixon?
That's a very good and complicated question. He said to me in a number of our interviews, because we talked about this a lot, he still doesn't understand Nixon, and he sees him as a very tragic figure. I think, first of all, at the time he became NSC advisor, he already had some very serious concerns about Nixon. And as I quote in the book, in 68, he's already saying to Rockefeller, when, of course, he doesn't know Nixon's going to get the Republican nomination, it would be a disaster if Nixon becomes president. And I think he's serious about that. He did not like Nixon. Most intellectuals did not like Nixon going back to the McCarthy era for all kinds of reasons. And certainly in 1960, he was a supporter of Kennedy, not Nixon's then. On the other hand, I think he has respect for Nixon's intellect, his understanding of foreign policy, his seriousness about that. And that's the thing we do have to remember. When we listen to the tapes, like the clip we played, you get Nixon, the hateful person, the man with lots of cursing and this and that. But he's also a very smart, engaged person. Doesn't mean we have to like it. But Kissinger saw that and recognized it. He was never tutoring the president. He was always trying to nudge and frame what the president did. But he wasn't going and telling the president what to do. This was not a relationship, even like Dean Acheson and Harry Truman. This was a relationship with a figure who had spent much of his life, Richard Nixon, dealing with foreign policy. As Eisenhower's vice president, that's what he spends most of his time on. He had visited a lot of the world. He had thought about these issues. So I think Kissinger has respect and still has respect for Nixon's foreign policy thinking, and when we talk about China, I think it comes up there, certainly, but also a great deal of concern about Nixon's inner demons, Nixon's insecurity, Nixon's tendency to fly off the handle, and Nixon's tendency to define all aims as coming back to his reelection.
Well, what about Nixon's view of Kissinger? Because with a lot of documents coming out, it looks as if he sort of saw Kissinger indeed as an outsider.
Absolutely. Oh, no doubt. One of the points my book makes that I really believe strongly in, and I should say, though Kissinger's not comfortable with my saying this, is that his Jewishness was an issue every day in the White House. I am struck by how often Nixon makes anti-Semitic comments to Kissinger's face, not just to his back. And you can say, well, he says bad things about everyone. He says racist things. He says sexist things. He says, and yes, but there is a way in which he digs at Kissinger that he doesn't for most other people, and particularly when he's mad. And usually he's mad at Kissinger when Kissinger's getting credit for something, and he's not.
Two insecure guys working together.
Absolutely. But I think this is absolutely crucial because Nixon's doing it for strategic reasons. He's trying to keep Kissinger off balance, and Kissinger constantly has to negotiate his way through that. Also, it comes up in the Middle East because they've got to make policy for the U.S. toward Israel and the Middle Eastern countries, especially after the 73 war. And it's quite clear that Nixon does not like Jews. He does not like the leaders of Israel, and he does not like American Jews, who he doesn't think are going to vote for him anyway. He really dislikes them, and this is a problem for policymaking in the area.
Henry Kissinger, China, Vietnam, and the Middle East. And how would a Jew negotiate with the Arabs, for example? Those questions when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Well, I had read it in an article he had written for Foreign Affairs. And Nixon talked about it, China opening in general terms in the first few weeks of the administration because he thought he could use it to bring pressure on the Soviet Union to help us in Vietnam. But it was not a very precisely formed concept other than that he would like to do it. But we had no idea how to do it and what opportunities might present themselves.
That's Henry Kissinger from an interview in 1999 talking about how he and Nixon initially thought about the opening to China. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Jeremy Suri, the author of Henry Kissinger and the American Century. Tell us about Henry Kissinger in China.
Well, this is the thing that Kissinger, like Nixon, try to take the most credit for it. One of the things they did, they say, is, in Kissinger's words, to revolutionize the world by opening relations between the United States and the communist Chinese government. Of course, the United States had never had relations with this government from 1948 on.
Table tennis? Is that what really
ping pong? Ping pong diplomacy. Some of the initial contacts were made by an American ping pong team that went over and was soundly defeated by the Chinese ping pong players, who were so much better. What Nixon and Kissinger, as Kissinger, I think, accurately describes in this interview, what they tried to do was to find a way in which they could, in essence, make the inevitable happen sooner, quicker, and more effectively for the United States. Why was it inevitable? Well, by the early 1970s, it was quite clear to everyone that the communist regime in China was the regime that was going to govern the society despite all the domestic chaos, and that it was, for basic practical reasons, it was a serious hindrance to the United States not to have relations with the society. They were major strategic actors in Asia. They were becoming a major player in terms of diplomacy. They were going to get seated at the United Nations. The United States had kept them from getting seated, but that was becoming more and more difficult as everyone else supported them being seated. So Nixon and Kissinger wanted to turn this to their advantage. And they wanted to turn this to their advantage in two ways. They wanted to use an opening to China to isolate the Soviet Union and give the United States leverage over the Soviet Union, in essence, to make sure that we, as the United States, had better relations with both communist states than they had with each other. These were two states that were involved in a serious border dispute. They had almost gone to war in 1969, and Nixon Kissinger realized, correctly, the United States could make itself the center, the vertex of the triangle between them. Second, and perhaps even more importantly, Nixon and Kissinger wanted Chinese help to get out of Vietnam. It became clear to them that the Chinese, as major supporters of North Vietnam, had leverage over North Vietnam, but it was also clear that they wanted that the Chinese wanted to escape this war as well. The war was draining China of resources, and the Chinese were getting more and more upset, evidently, with the North Vietnamese government for not listening to them. And so this was an attempt to try to work out a deal with the Chinese to make the North Vietnamese more willing to go along with American desires.
How did they go about getting, besides ping pong, to open relations?
Well, what they did, in classic Kissingerian fashion, and Nixon had the idea of doing this, but Kissinger was the one who tactically put it together, so I give Kissinger a lot of credit for this, though it had costs, is they found third parties they could work with secretly to organize this deal. The Pakistanis, the Romanians, the Poles, and others who had relations with both societies who could be trusted to be secretive about the initial overtures. Why was it important to be secretive? Well, one, they were concerned about opposition at home to this.
With communist China,
exactly. And in fact, Nixon is criticized very harshly by those in the Republican Party, many on the right, like William F. Buckley, for doing this. But second, they want to keep this secret because they don't want to give the Soviets or anyone else a chance to undermine it. They're afraid that as they're moving toward better relations with China, the Soviet Union or the North Vietnamese or someone will try to create a crisis that will bring these two societies back to war again. And so they want to do this in secret. And so you get this really curious situation where the Pakistani leadership, in particular Yahya Khan, becomes the main go-between between the United States and China. This has enormous costs. It works well in terms of benefits, but as I point out, it has enormous costs because it means we become, in a sense, committed to the Pakistani regime. And when Pakistan goes to war with India, that's one of the reasons the United States sides so firmly with Pakistan. We don't want to lose our Pakistani channel to China. If you're sitting in India, you don't like the way that looks at all, it seems to me.
Well, the secrecy, too, seems to me to become increasingly problematic.
Yes.
Because all kinds of negotiations with dictators later on, whether in South America or, you know, things are happening with no record of it.
That's absolutely right. There's no record of it. And for all of Kissinger's knowledge of what's going on, he does not know everything. And so by doing this in secret, he cuts himself off from particular expertise. And he's criticized quite a lot by Latin American and South Asian experts for this. He agrees to things callously that involve costs in human lives that he either doesn't care about or that he doesn't understand because he's one figure trying to deal with the whole world and doesn't realize the implications of what's going on. And that's a big, big problem for his policymaking.
Did it work?
The opening to China? Yes and no. It did work insofar as it created a relatively friendly relationship between Beijing and Washington that I would say has remained in place to this day. And it did put the Soviets in a corner, in a sense. So it worked in that sense. It did not work so much in Vietnam. And that's largely because the North Vietnamese, while they needed Chinese arms and support, were not beholden to the Chinese as much as the Americans were beholden, in a sense, to the Pakistanis. That's the curious thing about this. So I don't think it helped very much with the North Vietnamese. It might have helped marginally. But I wouldn't point to that as one of the explanatory variables for how the Vietnam War ends.
So did Kissinger's Vietnam War strategy succeed or fail in the long run in terms of getting out?
He succeeded in getting us out, finally. By 1973, there's an agreement. By 1975, American forces have withdrawn. He got us out, thankfully, right? And he deserves credit for that. But he deserves strong criticism for the way he did that and for the fact that the deal in the end in 1975 was not much better than the deal he could have negotiated in 1970. It looked better, but it was not that much better. And as a consequence, 40,000 Americans, 30,000 to 40,000 Americans died, as well as millions of Vietnamese.
And Vietnam still became communist.
Right, exactly. South Vietnam lasted for a matter of 9 months. So in that sense, I think his Vietnam policy does not look very good under close examination.
You include in your book a photo of a Time cover that calls him a magician.
Right.
Can you say something about the changing response or the popularity of Kissinger, how he's perceived by the American public as all these different negotiations are going along?
Well, I think I love that Time magazine cover from 1973 because I think it captures how people view him just at the times that he's opening the relations with China, negotiating an end to the Vietnam War. He is seen, as the cartoon shows, as this figure pulling a rabbit out of a hat. And in the image from Time magazine, all the leaders of the world are sitting there in awe of the great Kissinger. By the way, the great Kissinger in that image is clearly German and Jewish at the same time. He's clearly depicted as this ethnic figure. That's really important, too, I think. He's viewed this way because he seems to be the figure who finds some way to negotiate a solution to problems that seemed intractable. Not a solution everyone likes. It's not saying that he finds a perfect utopian outcome, but that he's able to move processes forward. He seems to be the figure you can send in and get work done. That's what seems to happen in Vietnam. That's what seems to happen in China. And most significantly, that's what seems to happen in the Middle East. And that cover is actually produced right after the 1973 war in the Middle East.
And why do you have the subtitle Henry Kissinger and the American Century? In other words, the reliance on Kissinger, the sense that he becomes this wizard, this magician, this figure that can move between lines and so on. How is that somehow an embodiment of the century?
Well, because I think that the American century is this transformation in America's role in the world that we still live with for better and worse today, particularly in the Middle East. And Kissinger's career was one of the driving forces, but it was also one of the manifestations of that. Without the changing role of the United States in the world, Kissinger is a nobody. He gets to where he is because of the nature of American power at the end of World War II, his placement in Germany at the end of the war, the role of Harvard University comes to play in strategic thinking, and the role of advisors to the president in making international policy, and the fact that he is the person people look to in the 70s to solve problems reflects America's standing in the world. There were other smart, ambitious people in other societies who thought they were peace negotiators or war negotiators, however you look at it, right? But yet people look to him. So to say this is the American century to me is not to be triumphal, but it is to say it's a period when the United States plays a role with inordinate power, but also inordinately interpenetrated by different influences that it wasn't interpenetrated by before. And he manifests that.
As a Jew, how does Henry Kissinger negotiate with the Arabs?
It's a very interesting story. It should be said that in addition to the issue of communism, the one other issue he generally stays away from in his career is the Middle East. He writes about every foreign policy area except the Middle East. You will not find, before 1970, any serious article Kissinger wrote about Israel. He stays away from that issue, as most Jews of his generation did. I remember my grandfather, who was also a Jewish immigrant, not wanting to talk about Israeli policy. You didn't talk about it. Too dangerous, right? He's thrust into a position as NSC advisor and then Secretary of State where he has no choice. There are problems exploding in the region from the day he's in office, from 1969, 1970 on, Jordanian civil war, etc. But then 1973, that war puts the United States in a situation where it has to have a significant policy in this area, and Kissinger becomes the point person for it. He finds himself in a situation where his Jewishness is on the table every single day. It's on the table at home. Everyone's commenting in the U.S. that here we have a Jewish NSC advisor, now Secretary of State, negotiating. The Arabs put it before him every day. As I show and quote in the book, it comes up in every conversation. The Saudis are my favorites about this. They give him a copy of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion at every single meeting to start the meeting to make sure he's off balance. The Israelis bring it up all the time. The Israelis are always saying, we expect more from you, Henry, right? You're one of us, right? So he's in this situation where he's trying to negotiate an end to the war and some sort of stable basis for the Middle East to function, with the United States exerting its influence without American soldiers on the ground doing this. He does not want a strong American intervention force, but he wants strong American influence. So what he does, I think brilliantly, though you can criticize it on ethical grounds, but what he does strategically is come up with an idea that he will find particular partners in the region to work with. And he will cozy up to these partners and use his Jewishness as a way of cozying up to them. He has no choice. Instead of avoiding the issue, he's going to turn it to his advantage. And Anwar Sadat is my favorite for this. He develops an incredibly close, affectionate relationship with Anwar Sadat, the leader of Egypt. And eventually this leads to the negotiation of a peace agreement between Israel and Egypt in 1978, the Camp David Accords, concluded by the Carter administration, that to this day have held peaceful relations between those two societies. That is the most successful, I would say, agreement that's been negotiated in the Middle East of the last generation, the only one that's really held.
I have to give Sadat a lot of credit for
Absolutely.
That, too, and he paid a price also.
He lost his life for it, as did to some extent the Israeli government, too. What Kissinger did in that arrangement was he convinced Sadat that he was the best person to deliver on that for Sadat. Kissinger was. Why? Because he had the power, he shared a vision with Sadat, and because he was Jewish, Sadat really believed that Jews ran the world. And Kissinger convinced him that he was the most powerful Jew in the world. So if you're going to make a deal with your Sadat, Kissinger's the one to make the deal with. Kissinger sells the deal to Israel on those terms as well. He makes it quite clear to the Israelis and even more clear to American Jews who meet with him. And he's the first Secretary of State to have all Jewish meetings at Foggy Bottom. The first time ever, and I interviewed people who were at these meetings, they recognize this. The first time ever you could have a meeting of all Jews in Foggy Bottom, because the first time you had a Jewish Secretary of State. He says to them quite explicitly, I'm the best you're going to get. Right? After me, there won't be a Jew.
So take advantage.
Exactly. Work with me, he says. Understand what I'm trying to do. Give up some territory for the sake of a better agreement. And I would say we can question the ethics of this, but it does produce this agreement that leaves many problems, that leaves a dictatorship in power in Egypt, allows the Israelis to maintain their somewhat dictatorial control over the occupied territories. We pay the price of that, but we do get the only sustained peace agreement in the Middle East 30 years later.
So if you had to sum up sort of the legacy of Henry Kissinger, put a phrase to him, it almost sounds as if you could call him brilliant yet unethical.
Yes, I think that's right. I think his career raises serious questions. This is one of the reasons I wrote the book and one thing I struggle with. How do you manage effectiveness in the international world with ethical strictures? He's someone who entered politics for moral purposes. I think that's what his experience led him to do in Nazi Germany. But he also cut a lot of moral corners for a larger moral purpose. Where did he go wrong and how did that happen? And where do we draw the line? I think this question we have to answer as we fight a war on terrorism, as we fight wars in Iraq and elsewhere, is where is the line for us? And his career doesn't answer that question. We need to answer that question.
Did you talk to him about Iraq?
Yes.
Yeah. What was his unofficial strategy for that?
Well, what he advised the Bush administration on in Iraq, I think, was that he supported the war, that we should go to war to eliminate what he saw as an unstable regime, a regime that threatened not terrorism per se, but threatened the stability of the region. But he never supported a sort of simple democratization agenda and never supported doing it unilaterally. He was very explicit to me, and he said this in a few op-eds, that the Bush administration mismanaged the diplomacy. He would have tried to make this more of a multinational effort. He would have certainly brought the UN in to deal with the reconstruction, not because he likes the UN, but because he recognized the United States couldn't do this on the cheap. Kissinger, I should say, hates the neocons, in part because the neocons criticized him in the 1970s.
Jeremy Suri, always a pleasure to have you with us for University of the Air.
Thank you. It was a wonderful conversation, as always.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.